they had these ministers, you know, in the government and all other really wise people. This one of these ministers was one of these real know-it-alls. Now, one of these people was just so smart, but really upset everybody else. So one day, the other ministers, they hatched a plan to get rid of this guy. And they said, this guy is so arrogant. He thinks he knows everything. This is the plan. One of us will say to him, you are so smart. And he's sure to say, yes, you know everything. He's bound to say, correct. Then we'll catch him out. We'll say, you probably know what we're all thinking about. And even if he gets it right, we'll say, no, that was wrong. Because who can prove what you're thinking? And that means we'll embarrass him in front of His Majesty. So they all agreed that was a smart plan. Because it said here, what number am I thinking of? Even if I get it correct, you can say, no, you're wrong. So that was the plan. And the following morning, in the meeting with the ministers, one of the ministers said, Your Majesty, you are so lucky and fortunate to have this great wise minister as one of your workers and helpers. He is so intelligent and smart. And the minister said, yes, I am. You probably know everything. Yes, I know everything, said this minister. He'd fallen into the trap of arrogance. So, said one of the ministers, you know everything, eh? Please tell the His Majesty what we're all thinking. And without any hesitation, this very smart minister said, everyone in this court, Your Majesty, is thinking kind thoughts towards Your Majesty. And all the ministers thought for a second and said, yeah, that's right. And thereby he got out of a very, very sticky situation. Because they weren't thinking kind of thoughts, but they have to admit that. Otherwise they get head cut off. If a painful feeling arises, pain in the knee, did you put your attention on it or let go of the pain? The third option. Do you put your attention on it? Let go of the pain? What's the third option? Move. The obvious one. So, nice thing to do, painful feeling, just move in the knee. That's a very good advice, because what happens, you're meditating, maybe half an hour goes past, and you've got a painful knee, but your meditation's, you know, reasonably okay. If you move your knee, very slowly, mindfully, your meditation, you go back. You lose ground. I'm only about, you know, 2 or 3 minutes. But once you've actually relaxed your knee, you make up that lost ground, you know, in a couple of minutes. So you're back where you were, but this time without any pain. So you can continue going deeper into meditation. Yeah, it is a disturbance, but it's a small disturbance. And moving the knee, or whatever else you're moving, it's only a disturbance for a few seconds. The pain is a disturbance for many, many, many minutes. So try moving. It works. Why not feed the kangaroos some grass? There is lots of grass the kangaroos have, but not our grass. The kangaroos are welcome to grass, but they go and pull it up by the roots and they mess up the lawns. It's a whole forest out there. So the kangaroos go into the forest to get your food. Stop messing around with us. So that's why we've got these fences. When the kangaroos started destroying the lawn, that was war. And little by little, we had many, many battles. We put the fence up. They jumped over the fence, so we put it higher. And then it's amazing what these kangaroos could do. They'd go through the fence. So we made it stronger. And then they found a shortcut. They would come right behind here and round and through, because we hadn't sort of blocked that off. So we put this little gate just over here. And we had these wonderful little cameras which actually caught them. They come here and they go there and sniff, and then, oh no, they couldn't get that way. So they tried another way. They came up the top, by the top cottages. And they would actually jump one leap down that staircase. Incredible.
And they jumped down to eat the grass. But then we put a gate up there. And then little by little, because we had our cameras, you know, nighttime cameras, they get these wildlife cameras, they get like anything which moves. We found out every one of their tricks. They thought they could outwit Ajahn Brahm. That's a big mistake. The kangaroos are built, you know, to actually this time of the year to go a little bit hungry. That's just the nature, because this is the nature of living in the Australian forest. But there's many of other little plants and stuff they can eat. They do fine. To be reborn as a human is very difficult, as the Buddha said. How to ensure that we can still be reborn as humans or conducive realm and still meet the Buddha teaching in the next life? You haven't died yet. Stop keeping thinking about the future so much. Didn't I tell you live in the present moment? You've got enough problems in this life. Let alone thinking about your next life. Oh, crikey. Now, the serious answer to that question is a saying of the Buddha, if the tree is leaning to the south, it's almost certain to fall to the south. If it's leaning to the north, it's liable to fall to the north when it dies. So that if you are living a good life, and if you really want to incline to the Buddha's teachings, then you incline to the Buddha's teachings in this life. You keep on going to temples, meditation retreats, reading Buddhist books, meditating. You're inclining so much in that direction, of course you will fall into another Buddhist life in your next life. It's obvious. But the next life, who knows what might happen in your next life? And you've still got this one to deal with. So don't waste time. Make sure that you are using your time wisely. Many people wanted to come on this retreat, but they couldn't get in. Many people are in this retreat and already want to go home. So now you're here, make the best use of it. In the Mahayana tradition, the concept of emptiness, very early on in the teachings, can you comment, please? Emptiness. We've already been talking about emptiness throughout the whole of this retreat. And I usually leave emptiness to the end of the retreat. Because at the end of the retreat, my teaching on emptiness is, the donation box is empty. Your wallets are full. So empty your wallets. And realize the great emptiness. It doesn't work. It's a good line though. So, the emptiness is a wonderful thing to understand, emptiness. But it's the empty of what? Because emptiness, just as a concept, people can actually just think about that and get so confused. But emptiness is a relative term. And the way the Buddha described it was, in the Sunyata Sutta, is, you're in this retreat. What's missing? What's empty in this retreat? All the noise of the traffic in your hometown, all the busyness with your wife, with your kids, with your husband, that you're empty of that. All the emails and telephone calls, shopping, all that is missing. So the Buddha was saying it's nice every now and again, actually a lot, to focus on what's missing. And then you really appreciate just this place. And then you go and sit down and do meditating, and you just close your eyes. What's missing? All this visual clutter of people and stuff and things. Your mind is so much more free when you don't have to worry about seeing things. And you go deeper into meditation, you become empty of time. No past, no future anymore. Feel so free because the past is a huge burden on many people. And not just an emotional burden, a financial burden. Because of all that past stuff you carry around, you have to pay psychologists and therapists so much money. So here, you're free of the past, so you don't need to see any psychologists. And the future, you're free of all that, free of all fear. You're empty of time. And then you go into even deeper emptiness because time has disappeared. And then your body vanishes. Yeah, I'm empty of all these aches and pains and itches and tummy aches and headaches and eye aches and ear aches. All of those stuff you're free of. You're empty of the body. And then You're empty of thoughts. You look at the mind, what do you think about? Nothing. Have you ever noticed the more empty you are, the more free you are, the more happiness you can have? Just like when you have a room and there's too much stuff in it. You can't even walk around people's rooms these days. I don't know how people do any housework. There's too much stuff to move. Now, at the end of this retreat, we pack up all of those things. It's such an easy room to clean because there's hardly anything in it. The emptiness is absolutely brilliant. You feel so free when you've got nothing in your room. And you feel so free when you've got nothing in the room of your mind. All the thoughts are gone. Freedom at last. That's the start of emptiness. And then the mind watches the breath, and then the breath vanishes. You're free of the breath, empty again. And then the will vanishes. You're empty of having to make choices. Making choices is such a pain. That's why when I used to go to shopping before I became a monk, the shops were so simple. If I wanted to get some muesli, there was only one brand of muesli. Now, there's hundreds of brands. When I wanted to get some milk, it was just milk. Now there's low fat, now there's soya milk, there's rice milk, and there's enhanced milk and light milk. And it's just really confusing. It's like that story, the refugee who came from Syria into Australia. And he'd never seen a supermarket before. And when he actually walked inside, he was really stunned at what he saw there. First thing he saw was milk powder. All you need to do is take this powder, add water, stir it up, and you get milk. He thought, wow, it's amazing. Where I come from, you have to get a cow first and milk it to get milk. Really hard work. But these days in the West, you just add water and you get milk. And then he went to another aisle, instant mashed potato. You get this powder, you put it in, add hot water, stir it up, you get mashed potato. He said, oh, where I come from, we have to, you know, sow the potatoes and put the plants in and just water them. And when they're ready, we actually dig them out. And then we have to wash them and peel them and boil them and then we mash them. It's just hard work. Over here, all you need to do is to add water, hot water, and you get mashed potatoes. Incredible. And then he went to another aisle and you almost dropped down dead. These Westerners are so amazing. Baby powder. Back where he came from, you had to get a wife.
Modern technology. Anyway, that's my baby powder joke.
Just add water, you get a baby. So anyway, the emptiness is when there's so much choice, it's so much of a pain. Here, that's one of the nice things about being on retreat. You've got no choice. Nothing to do, nothing to choose. The food, take it or leave it. You don't have a menu. You don't have to think, oh, should I have this one? Should I have that one? What should I cook today? What should I do? It's so easy when you don't have any choice. So you're empty. And the more empty you are, the more free you feel. So we don't use these things as like metaphysical concepts where people can argue who's the most empty and what emptiness really means. We experience it little by little in our meditation, what emptiness feels like. There's no one there. Free. What is the benefit of living with a community of monks? Isn't it better to live as hermits in solitude? If you live as hermits in solitude, you can go crazy. I did a 6-month retreat once. And in those 6 months, I never saw another human being, not one. I didn't speak to anybody. 6 months of perfect solitude. Some of you were here when that happened. And many of the monks, especially the lay people, were really wondering, when he comes out, will he have his big wild eyes? Will he be bonkers? Crazy. And they were really disappointed that I was sane. So, sometimes, because if you can meditate, great. But can you be in solitude even in this retreat? Can you stay in your room all day? Sometimes, yeah, it's nice to think you can live as a hermit, but many hermits go insane. Because when you're with other monks, they keep you back in line. If you go a bit odd, they soon sort of give you a kick up the backside and just tell you. That's why, you know, I'm getting quite famous now, and I rely on these guys to keep me honest. If they see me getting a bit up myself, they let me know, and they do. Which is great, because I get the feedback from them. So that's wonderful. When you live with another community, you know, they reflect. You know, you can reflect yourself off them, and they will let you know whether you're in the right path or not. It's so easy to be wise by yourself. But when you have to deal with other people, that's when you understand how your wisdom is. It's easier to say to all the monks you live with in your cave, may all the monks be happy and well. But when they come right up in front of you and do absolutely stupid things, where's your metta then? So this is actually where you learn real loving kindness and real peace. You give up, you build up the energy and the wisdom and the compassion by yourself, but then you test it out when you're living with other people. So in the community of monks, the way that I've tried to establish it is a balance between solitude and community. Having enough time to be in solitude, but also spending time together as well. I think that's the best. Actually, I remember that the old dean of the Anglican Cathedral, John Shepherd, he told me once that even in the Anglican Church they have hermits because he once went to a conference of hermits. And what a weird thing that is. A conference of hermits. If you go to conferences, you're not a hermit. And also, they had on hermits somebody, it's actually Lynn Jackson, she got this article out for me, which called Ornamental Hermits. Because in about, I think it was the, what was it, 1890s or something in England, all these lords who had their stately homes, it became a fashion accessory to build a grotto in your stately home estate and get a hermit to live in it. And they would actually, no, it's absolutely true, because all the records there, they would advertise in the newspapers for hermits. So that the lord, you know, after dinner, could take their guest to see their hermit in their grotto. And they had regulations for the hermits. You know, they had to stay at least 3 years, but they gave them a large sum of money. It was actually really a good little earner for a hermit. 3 years of doing this, and then you could basically retire. And you would get the best food from the kitchen. Food was no problem at all. But you weren't allowed to cut your hair, or cut your nails, or wash. You had to, you know, look wild. And that was called the Ornamental Hermits. And there was one of these guys became an ornamental hermit, and they really looked the part. You know, really long hair, sort of, you know, unkempt, stinky. And, you know, it's very easy to say smart things. Or if you want to appear wise, just say things which are totally nonsensical. The floor and the sky are one. And they say, wow, that's really deep. Because you don't understand it. What does he mean by that? The floor and the sky are one? There's no separation. Yeah, yeah. So it's very easy to say smart aleck things that appear wise. So then you had to do that. But one of these guys, he got the sack because, you know, the lord of the manor just happened to be passing the pub and found the hermit used to go in there every evening after work. And that's not the place where hermits are supposed to go. You're not supposed to go down the pub. You're supposed to stay in your grotto and just, you know, be crazy. But anyway, that was the ornamental hermits. Were fashionable for about 10 years. You get a job as a hermit. And then just after 3 years you can retire and just live off your earnings. So of course that became fashionable, and then, you know, like many things, became out of fashion. So that they had to get another job afterwards. An interesting time, ornamental hermits. Anyway, is the Ajahn Chah tradition part of Mahanikaya or Dhamma Yut? What's the difference? What's the difference is, as Buddhist monks, we don't indulge in sex. S-E-C-T-S. So it's all sectarianism, and none of that has nothing to do with Buddhism at all. It's just politics and power. That's all that stuff is. And unfortunately, if you're in Thailand, you have to be officially part of one sect. But you know that this is just Thailand. In the north of Thailand, they are so independent. They actually don't really feel they belong to the kingdom, which is in the central part of Thailand. There's four parts of Thailand: central Thailand, northeast, north, and the south. And culturally, they're very different. And the northerners, Chiang Mai, that area, has always been independent. And they really rebel against being told what to do by these monks in Bangkok. Which is one of the reasons why that many of the bhikkhuni monasteries are up in the north of Thailand. North of Thailand, the monks don't care. Yeah, bhikkhunis, why not? Central Thailand, that's just power. Northeast is like the Bible Belt. They're just so traditional up there. And so Ajahn Chah, was he Mahanikaya or Dhammayutta? Now for him, he was just Buddhist. He didn't want anything to do with that sort of stuff. Politics as well. Same as in Sri Lanka and in Burma. You know, I've asked learned senior Sri Lankan monks, how many sects or Nikayas are there in Sri Lanka? Not even they know, because there's so many of them. And they'll keep splitting up. And what the Buddha said, isn't it wonderful, if where there was disharmony, different sects, we bring them all together. So somebody once tried that, bringing them together, and it made a third sect, the bringing everything together sect. That's so stupid. And why do people do that? It's just, again, power and privilege, which has really nothing to do with Buddhism at all. So it makes me embarrassed that there's any sect at all in Buddhism, just Buddhism. Even it makes me embarrassed that Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, Buddhists, for goodness sake. It doesn't make any difference where you ordain, what type of robe you wear. You're a Buddhist monk or a Buddhist nun. Like the Venerable over there, she was asking me, if I go and stay, I don't know if I'll give the game away here, go and stay in Dharamsala, would I need to reordain? Of course you don't, you're a bhikkhuni. You just change your robe, that's all, to a different fashion. And if Venerable Karunika wanted to go and stay in your master's monastery, she would need to reordain and just change the robe into a Mahayana style. That's all you need to do. If His Holiness the Dalai Lama wanted to come to Bodhinyana, he could come, he'd just change his robe to one like this. No problem at all. So this is actually just, there is no real sect in Buddhism. The Buddha never really encouraged that. So then people come along and ask me, okay, Ajahn Brahm, what sect are you? Because, you know, I really, really give a lot to Buddhism. And people say, you are more Mahayana because you're like a bodhisattva. Just what you do, sacrifice all your time for others. You know, you're really Mahayana. And even one of the monks, the head monk in Singapore, used to say that. He said, you're Theravada on the outside, Mahayana on the inside. That's what he used to say. And I said, no. Because I like to bring everybody together. That's one of my goals in life. And so, my tradition, my sect, is a combination of Theravada, Mahayana, and Vajrayana. The other word for Theravada is Hinayana. So I take the H from Hinayana, the Aha from Mahayana, and the Yana from the Tibetan tradition, Vajrayana. And what does that spell? Hahayana. That is my traditional Buddhism. Yana. And if you get enlightened in my tradition, become a Hahaharahat. It's much more fun putting some joy and fun in meditation. Cracky. Anyway. Next question, how do I get over the condition that I need to be busy always? Oh my crikey. After Goenka meditation course, I feel guilty if I'm not on my cushion all the time. It's the guilt you should feel guilty about. You know, feeling guilty, that's nothing to do with Buddhism. So if you are guilty, feel guilty about being guilty. You don't need to be busy always. The point of Buddhism is learning how to relax, be free, to overcome the hindrances, the defilements. They call these the kilesa, greed, hatred, and delusion. Greed. That's what you're busy for. What are you trying to get? Where are you running to? What are you trying to achieve? This is one of the problems. When I was at school, a schoolboy, I was interested in religion. So I went up, there's a really good school. I got scholarships there. Scholarships all the way. And then they had because it was a good school, had all these great actors in there. There's one who died recently, used to go there. He was Professor Snape in Harry Potter. What was his name? Sorry? Alan? Rickman. Oh, Rickman, that's right, yeah. He went to my school. As did, what's his name? There was in 40 Towers, the waiter. Emmanuel, yeah. He's not from Barcelona, he's from Chiswick. I knew that guy. And Hugh Grant, he went there as well. So it's like it became an acting school because it was in that area of West London, you know, close to the BBC, where all these actors used to go and get their start. So it's an acting school. That's where I get my ability to present and to tell jokes. Well, anyway, what did I go? That's cool. They had a chaplain. So I went to see him one day, and just, I was really interested, sincere, that I can't really get my head around this idea of God. Now, what is God? Explain it to me. And he said something like, you know, the God is inexplicable. It's ineffable. It's beyond words. It's the ground of all being, the beginning and end of all things. And I couldn't make no head nor tail of that. I couldn't make any sense of it. What do you mean the ground of all being? The ground I get some idea of, being, but ground and being? The beginning and end of all things? Inexplicable. Now, give me some concrete knowledge of what this God is. And he could never tell me. That's one of the reasons why I gave up. I couldn't really understand what this God was truly about. And then later on, when I got interested in Buddhism at university, I remember going up to a monk and said, this Nibbana, what is Nibbana anyway? And he said, it's beyond words, it's inexplicable, it's the ground of all being. So I've heard that before, you don't know what you're talking about. So a lot of times, you're busy, where are you going? A lot of times for many Buddhists, you're trying to get to Nibbana, you haven't got a clue what Nibbana is. Imagine that, you get on a bus, or you get a taxi, say, get a taxi, and say, where do you want to go, sir? I don't know, but take me there. That's like people meditating, trying to get to Nibbana. Take me there, but I don't know where I'm going, I don't know what Nibbana is. Imagine, when you get there, you may not like it. Are you sure you really want to go to Nibbana? You know where you're going? It's crazy stuff, isn't it? So, I gave you a good idea of what Nibbana is. Contentment. Be so content you don't need any more wishes. The end of desire. Now that is something I can get my head around. And hopefully you can. You get some idea of what this is doing. Where you're going. Contentment. Peace. Freedom at last. And you know that because you've had experience of moments of contentment. Hopefully here. I'm always very pleased. You see some people just, before I came in here, just sitting just on the concrete road, just watching the sun go down. Sitting on the stupa, just watching the trees grow. Just sitting there, just so content. Just they're not doing anything, they're not going anywhere. They're not busy. They're going in totally the opposite direction. When I see that, great, you're getting somewhere in your meditation. You're not always trying to get things. You're just being in the moment, enjoying the beautiful scenery, enjoying peace. And doesn't that feel good? You're getting a taste of freedom. A freedom from wanting. Contentment. And when you get that taste of freedom, you get some great understanding, insight into where we're going in this meditation. And you don't feel guilty anymore about stopping. About being free. So that's how you overcome that guilt, by sitting out there and doing nothing. Just when I think I'm getting close, the saliva gets in the way. How to stop it? Okay. very easy, because we haven't actually got one yet, but I think if we have enough donations at the end of this retreat, I've been promising this for a long while, we'd actually buy one. One of those machines you see in the dentist. A little... and that could be for you. But it works in the dentist, so it can work here. So the saliva gets in the way. If you put your attention on the saliva, then it does get in the way. And if you keep focusing on the saliva, it comes out more and more, and you don't know whether you should swallow it. You decide not to swallow it, then you dribble, then you swallow it. And the more you swallow, the more it makes. And it just ends up just, you know, the saliva dribbling meditation. So it's really a waste of time. So the point is, don't pay attention to it. You're working, you're driving your car, and the saliva comes in and out without you noticing it, quite naturally, without a problem at all. As soon as you focus on it, it becomes a problem. Interesting, isn't it, in life? We focus on things, and we mess it up. It becomes a problem. Leave it alone, it sorts itself out. So the way to do that is use the centering your attention not on the saliva, but say on the breath, whatever else you're watching when you meditate. Keep that in the center. The saliva's on the edge over here somewhere. So let it dribble over the edge of the screen, not down your mouth, until it just vanishes. It falls off the screen because you're not giving it importance anymore. And then it just stops. When I was meditating yesterday, one time, and this morning I could hear long distance monks chanting sound. It was a little disturbing. I'm not sure. Is it just an imaginary thing or just a mind playing around? Hear the long distance chanting from the monks, all the way from Bodhinyana. Except my monks don't chant. Was it from Dharamsala? Was it the nuns in the cottage doing their morning chanting? No, they're up early. No, all it actually is, if it was disturbing, then, if it's a lot of times you hear these sounds and they're not disturbing, they're very sweet and joyful. And that, if it's sweet and joyful, all you smell fragrances in this hall. Now maybe just jasmine, or, you know, just walking outside, just beautiful fragrant smells of sandalwood or something. Then that is a sign that your mind is becoming very strong. Whatever you smell becomes beautiful. Whatever you see becomes delightful. Whatever you hear, even the sound of the aircon, becomes like the sound of someone chanting. This is just the way that perception starts to create beauty. And that is not uncommon, that people hear the sound of monks chanting, but it's beautiful, it's delightful. It is just your sense of sound becomes enhanced, and it's something beautiful you hear. It is a little disturbing, that's, I'm not quite sure what that is. But it is usually an imaginary thing, it is the mind playing around, so just leave it alone. Don't really pay too much attention. The last few days some images came to mind, people, trees, water, etc. They flash fast, come and go, great, they go, so let them go. Whatever happens in meditation doesn't really matter as long as you have the right reaction to it. You don't get excited, you don't get afraid. Things come, things go, and let them go. How can we survive without Bianca? That's what it says in here. Actually, this looks like you're writing, Bianca. No, it doesn't. Thank you, Bianca, for your selfless service. And may you reach Nirvana before end of this... If she reaches Nirvana before the end of this retreat, there's no more food. So please, may she reach Nirvana after the end of the retreat. Otherwise, you're not going to eat anymore. That's very nice. It's very nice to have gratitude. All the people who've made this center happen, and all the people who look after it. And all these people who just bring you food. Every day, that's really impressive. And the people... I was actually just giving interviews and I saw it was the Vietnamese group gave food this morning. You know, they don't just come here to feed you beautiful food. I saw them after they came all this way, spent all this money, They don't get paid for this. This is their gift. After serving the food, I saw them in a donation box, putting money in the donation box. Having given you all that food, they give a donation for the privilege of serving you. That's really impressive. I thought, wow, this is just really sort of fills you full of happiness and joy. That people realize this is a place they want to support. And they make all this food. They do the very best they can to feed you. And when I came back from Bodhinyana, I eat over there so I can see everybody. I saw the Vietnamese and I said, how did it go? I said, oh, we're so happy. There's hardly anything left. And when they see you enjoying that food, that makes them so joyful. That's such a beautiful part of this tradition. You know, we don't sort of, you know, hire caterers. That would be just yucky. People actually do this and give this for free. It's wonderful. I think self-doubt is one of our biggest obstacles. I, and I'm sure others, often have thoughts like this. I'm already behind. I should have started this years ago. I need to make up for lost time. What do you recommend to overcome these thoughts? It is the ones ahead. They're the ones in trouble. Because I know many cyclists. There's one of the up-and-coming youth cyclists was at our monastery today, Talay. She's in the youth championships in Australia, trying to get into the world championships. And in cycling, you always stay behind. Because right at the very end, the one behind is the only one who can overtake. The one in front doesn't know how fast they're going or who's behind them. And the one behind always wins. Because I remember seeing this when I was a kid. They had these two cyclists on the track, racing, just one-on-one. And both of them were perfectly still. It's a race. They were just balanced. They weren't moving at all. They were waiting for the other one to move. Because the one who was in front, just in the last lap, would always be beaten. And it was a crazy... Have you seen that? It's a race. Two cyclists, and they were perfectly stationary next to each other. Just a battle of wills, who would actually move first. Crazy stuff. But that's like meditation. The ones in ahead always end up last. And the ones who are behind, you're the ones on the last lap, the last day of the retreat. You overtake everybody. Because you are the humble ones. The ones ahead are just so arrogant and up themselves. But you, the ones who are not arrogant, who give up all your desires. You say, it doesn't matter. May everyone else be enlightened before me. And that type of letting go mind is the one which works. So self-doubt, you should have self-doubt, the right self-doubt, the doubt there's no self. Now that is a very good doubt to have. Do I really exist? Can I do anything? No, so you let go. You can't achieve enlightenment. You can't meditate. As I said yesterday, Ajahn Brahm can't get jhanas. I vanish. No more Ajahn Brahm. And then all these wonderful things happen. So doubt the self and trust the no self. So it is self-doubt, no self-trust. That is the way to go. Just like that old joke I said in the dining area, we should have two lines when you have the buffet every day. Self-service for those not enlightened, and no self-service for those who realize there's no one there. Dear Ajahn, how can I get rid of the melancholy feeling I experience very often? Thanks. Don't try to get rid of it. Welcome it. Thank you for being melancholy. On this retreat some years ago, there was a girl, she's become very famous now, because, you know, she was Indonesian. I won't mention her name, but her first name was Ronnie. And you all know her. Part of the KM group. So you know who Ronnie is. She was the one coming after 5 or 6 days in the interviews. So I feel terrible. I feel so sad and grumpy and fed up. Everyone else is happy, but I'm not. And I get really fed up with, you know, having to be happy. Because that's a problem, isn't it? You've got the pressure on you. Come on. If you meditate and then you have a smile on the face, you see other people with a smile on the face and they're meditating really good, that really pisses you off. I'm not getting anywhere. I'm really fed up. This place sucks. You're really melancholy. So, she came to complain that too many other people were happy. She wasn't. So I saw her problem straight away, went into the office, opened up the computer, and wrote out this little letter, printed it out on the letterhead paper, and it was the first ever grumpy license. And it was really nice. You can get really nice font on the computer, just like it was like one of the degrees from a university. And there was this grumpy license on the top in sort of some Gothic script. And underneath, this license gives permission to Veronica, whatever her name was, to be grumpy at any time, for any reason or no reason whatsoever, for the rest of her life, signed. And I put my full title, which is His Roundness, Ajahn Brahm. And I dated it, and I presented it to her. And so she got the first question. She now had permission to be melancholy or to be grumpy. And as soon as she had permission to be grumpy, she had this huge smile on her face and was happy for the rest of the retreat. But if you try to not be melancholy, that really makes you sad. But if you have permission to be melancholy, to be grumpy, I give you permission, because she really trusted me, she had faith in me, she respected me. So when her teacher signed this, now she could be grumpy, and she never felt guilty about it ever again. And then she was free, and she started becoming happy. So don't get into the melancholy. I don't want to be melancholy. That's the problem, not being melancholy. I don't want to be melancholy. That reaction is what keeps the melancholy going. Is the Katina a traditional annual festival of Buddhists? Is it according to the Lord Buddha's teachings? Yeah, it is. We did that ceremony every year. So that's in October sometimes. It's in the original Vinaya. They used to do it in the time of the Buddha. Yeah, you know, it sort of changes a little bit, gets a bit exaggerated. We do a lot of fun and games. But it is, the original was there in the time of the Buddha. That's actually where I first read that some of the teachings there, in the Katina ceremony, people offer a robe. And had this occasion where a king was offering a robe. And all the other people said, the king gets all the merit. We don't have a chance to make merit because we're too poor. We can't offer a robe to the monks. It's not fair. The king gets this all the time because he's a king. That's where the Buddha said, no. When the king comes in to offer the robe, you say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. You rejoice in that offering. And you get exactly the same good karma as if you offered the robe yourself. Because you rejoice in the offering. And I thought, that's such a beautiful part of understanding the law of karma. Sometimes people can't afford giving gifts or putting donations in, but they see somebody else put a donation in a box and you rejoice in it. You also share in the karma now. And to me, that was something I never really understood before I became a Buddhist. I thought, you know, if you do the donation, you get the merit. Other people don't, they get nothing. If you're a poor person, you've got no chance. This is a wonderful way where poor people have the opportunity. You don't need to buy anything. Totally unmaterial. Just your mind rejoicing in it. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. What a beautiful thing that is. And you make merit that way. That was absolutely beautiful. And that was from the Katina ceremony. Where I first learnt that. That's why, you know, many people... You come to Katina here... You get a robe from this person, and they'll go round and round celebrating, ahoy, ahoy, ahoy. There's really a celebration. They're all celebrating the gifts. So they're getting part of the good karma as well. It's wonderful. Sometimes some of the Westerners say, what are they doing? This is stupid. Oh, you're missing your chance to make good karma. Ajahn Brahm, when you encounter the fear that you talked about this morning, what do you do? Nothing. I just cannot seem to get past one point. Almost feels like self-created barrier. Any advice? Yeah, the simile I give is like taking a kid, an infant, to the swimming pool for the first time in their life. 3-4 years of age, they've just learned to walk on solid land, And now they're having to walk on this really strange stuff called water. Imagine what it must be like for a child going to a swimming pool for the first time. It's scary because you've never been there before. So what do? You put your feet in. Take it out quickly. That sounds okay. Then you put the leg in. Take it out. That was okay. Then you put two legs in. Then you dangle the kid in, half out. Kid likes that. Then you drop the kid in the pool. And once the kid's in the pool, you can't get them out again. It's too much fun. That is like just when you come across fear, just put your toe in. Just go a bit further in. Come out again. What was that like? Oh, that's actually quite nice. Go a little bit further in. That's okay. When you go really in, you can't come out again. Because these peaceful states of meditation are just so beautiful. You stay there for hours. That's what actually happens. The fear, why are you afraid? The same as the fear of someone who's been in prison for 20, 30 years. Tomorrow their sentence is over, they're going to get released. Terrified. They're not used to freedom. They're used to being in prison with the institution. That's what they got used to. That's what they're comfortable with. So understanding that a prisoner who's about to be released, if you just let them out the door, or sometimes they just can't handle it. 20, 30, 40 years in jail. So what do? You have like day release, work release. Just go out for the weekend and come back again. To get used to life outside. So it overcomes the fear. A gradual moving away from your prison into freedom. But don't go too far, come back again. So here, what we're doing, we're giving you 9-day release from your prison. You're going to go back there on Sunday, but at least you're getting some idea what it's like. So that's actually how you overcome the fear, and that's where the fear comes from. It was a prison you're in, but even so, you're comfortable in your prison. Or like that, one of my favorite stories about, this is for Anna in the back, the worm in the pile of cow shit. That's one of my favorite stories. It's the last story in Good, Bad, Who Knows. No, last story in Open the Door of Your Heart. And that became the title for the Indonesian versions of my book. As the Indonesian people here know, the cacing, the worm. And once there were two monks. They were the best of friends. And they were practicing, but when they died and passed into the next life, one of those monks, because he was a good monk, got reborn in a beautiful heaven realm. So refined and peaceful and joyful and pure. While he's a friend, because of some bad karma he did, got reborn as a worm in a pile of cow shit. And after enjoying heaven for a little while, the heavenly being thought, hey, I wonder where my friend's gone. And so, using the powers of a heavenly being, this heavenly being, the ex-monk, scanned all the heaven realms looking for his friend. Couldn't find him anywhere. And he thought, I wonder where he's been reborn. And he thought, human life is one of the most fortunate ones. So he scanned all the human realm. Couldn't find his friend there either. Oh my goodness, he hasn't been born as an animal, has he? So he scanned all the realm of the elephants and the gorillas and all the higher beings and couldn't find him there. But wouldn't give up, and finally he found that his friend had been reborn amongst the realm of the creepy crawlies as a worm in a pile of cow shit. Oh my goodness. If your friend is in trouble, if you really know what friendship is, you will always sacrifice anything to help them. So this heavenly being vanished from the heavenly realms and appeared in front of this pile of stinky, filthy cow shit. And he called out, hey worm, worm, come out! And this little worm head poked up through the cow shit. And he said, what do you want? Oh, we used to be the best of friends in the past life. Really, said the worm? Yeah. We were monks together. No kidding, really?
And he said, yeah, and look, I've been reborn in this beautiful heaven world, and you've been reborn in this stinky pile of shit. I can help you out. Come with me, I'll take you to heaven. And the worm said, just hang on a moment. Just wait for a second. I want to ask some questions before I go. And the main question is, in your heaven place, whatever that's like, is there any cow shit? Of course not! That's filthy. We don't have stuff like that in heaven. Even in heaven, we don't even say the word. Only in the human realm do they say the shit word. We don't have that stuff in heaven. Of course not. So the worm said, well, no cow shit, I'm not going. Because cow shit is my food. It's delicious. And it's my home as well. It's fragrant. And it's so nice and warm inside the bottom of the cow shit. This is lovely. Why didn't you come in here and stay with me, said the worm to the heavenly being. And the heavenly being realized, this worm just did not understand the truth. How can I actually convince this worm that cow shit is filthy and dirty and stinky and awful and heaven is much better? So, he decided to use some force. He grabbed hold of the worm and he tried to pull the worm out of the pile of cow shit. But the worm didn't want to go. And because the worm was covered with all this slimy shit, it wriggled and tried to escape, and of course it was so slippery, it escaped and went right down the very bottom. But friendship is so strong that even this was a heavenly being. Not even you would do this. It was a high heavenly being. He put his hand in there again and again until he found that worm and pulled him out again. But that worm just struggled and escaped again many, many times. He tried to get him out. Almost got him out a few times, but every time the worm wriggled and escaped and hid deeper into the pile of shit. And at the very end of the story, that heavenly being had to go back to heaven and leave his friend in the pile of shit. Why? Because his friend was so attached to his pile of shit. It's fragrant, it's warm, it's wonderful, it's my food. For many years, some of you have been coming on this retreat, and I've been trying to get you out of your pile of shit. I almost get you out, and what happens after the retreat? You go back home again. Why? Oh, because home is nice. It's fragrant. It's all my food. That's why it's hard when you get afraid. The worm is afraid. I don't want to get out my shit. It's fragrant. It's what you get used to. What you get attached to. And going to outside of your piles of shit is pretty scary sometimes. That's why it's really hard for teachers. That's not a great story, isn't it? Yeah, it's a bit offensive, I agree, but it's so accurate. Anyway, next question. Free from delusion means when we understand about anatta. Now, you understand about dukkha as well. You understand what shit is, and you're in it. But there's a way out. But, you know, the delusion is thinking shit is fragrant. That's a delusion. I'm so happy. I've got a nice wife, nice kids, nice life. Everything is nice. I live in Australia. I live in Mumbai, wherever you live. Life is good. Really? That's what the worm thinks too. Yeah, but delusion is, this is how the Buddha described it, is thinking, viewing what is suffering to be happiness. What is permanent, or is impermanent to be permanent, and what is non-self to be a self. That's what delusion is. Getting it all wrong. Please explain the Four Noble Truths. Thanks. Easy. Shit. Ajahn Sujato is doing a new translation of the suttas. And he was looking for a modern word for dukkha, the first of the Four Noble Truths. And he came up with a modern translation. In his translation, the first noble truth is, life is shit. Instead of life is dukkha, or life is suffering. Because that hits home. Say life is suffering, it hasn't got the same power to it. So that is his first noble truth. I'm just quoting someone else, okay? So don't blame me, blame him. First noble truth, life is shit. Second noble truth, the cause of shit. Third noble truth, that letting go of the cause is to stop shit. And the way to stop the shit is the Eightfold Path. Those are the Four Noble Truths. That's actually brilliant. Because you remember that now. It's gross, it's coarse, but so is life. The Four Noble Truths. It's brilliant when you're a Westerner, you can mess around with these things. People in Asia would never do that. We do it, we get away with it. It's great fun. Thanks. Thanks for the jokes. And people say, no, you monks are really crazy. Life is fun. Life is wonderful. Yeah? Thanks for the joke and sharing your wisdom. Please explain the difference between tanha and chanda regarding the second noble truth, craving. And chanda is an interesting Pali word. And I've been encouraging other people to study and learn Pali, because when you study and learn these languages, you don't use the dictionary so much. I followed this great professor, A.K. Ward, who said you'd get some rough understanding of what the words mean, but then read and read and read the sutras, and you see how those words are used in real speech or real prose. And the context starts to define them. And that's where I especially like the Vinaya, because those were actions, things people did and said. It wasn't philosophy. It was real life. That's where you find like Nibbana meant the flame going out, because it was used in real speech, and from that real speech it was applied to philosophy, to more abstract ideas. And chanda is used, you know, when say a monk or a nun can't go to the ceremony, to the meeting, they give their approval, their consent, they're okay to what goes on. That's called chanda. And it's a wonderful idea of getting this idea. It's like you approve, you consent to all of this. You don't try and stop it or resist it. You consent. You give your okay to it. You go along with it, rather than stopping it and saying no to it. So it's a type of craving, but a very refined one. Also, please mention the dog cow ascetics or alternative destination if they held wrong view regarding their ascetic practices. Yeah, it's the dog ascetic. You practice like a dog, you become a dog. That's what you associate with. If you spend too much, I shouldn't really say this, no, I won't say that. I was going to say, because once I start, I can't stop. I tell this to the monks. Sleep if you're really tired, but if you spend too much time sleeping, if you spend too much time in a horizontal position, you'll get reborn as a horizontal animal. Like a snake or a worm, things which actually crawl along the ground because you don't know how to be upright anymore. So anyway, that's just a bit of a joke for the monks, but you're okay because you're upright most of the time. And it's also, it's only a case of people really get into sleeping too much, which is very rare for people these days because people are far too motivated. So the dog and the cow get reborn as a dog or a cow, but if it's really wrong view, and especially if you use those wrong ideas to criticize other people, then sometimes you get so guilty about what you did and what you've done. It's a self-punishment when you realize you've got it all wrong. That is what drives you to a lower realm, even a hell realm. Do hell realms exist in Buddhism? Yes, they do. What type of hell realms are there? And people look at all of those paintings on the temples. And I've seen people going around these old Buddhist temples, and the ones they look at the most are the pictures of the hell realms. You really weird, psychotic people. You always like to see other people. The heaven realms, people actually go past that very quickly. It's just like when I was in England once, there were some monks visiting from Thailand, and I offered to help look after them. And they wanted to see something English, so they went to Warwick Castle, see an old English castle. So they went inside the castle, and where they wanted to have a look, where everyone else was going, was the dungeons, the torture chambers. That was the most popular part of the castle to go and have a look at. People are weird. They always like seeing suffering. It's really strange. But anyway, on those photos or pictures on the wall, they have all these ways of suffering, of being boiled in oil or being poked with these demons with big eyes. But that was so 2,500 years ago. Torture has advanced to those days. Now we get more modern forms of punishment. So down in hell, every time you try and log on to your emails, it always crashes. Every time you try and send an email, you get the spam from somebody in Russia who likes you. I get that on my emails as well. Sort of, I forget what his names are, something like, Ivana from Russia wants to contact you. And I'm a monk. Come off it, Ivana. Oh, the worst hell, I always think, is the karaoke hell, because I really don't like karaoke. So in the karaoke hell, you are there and you have to put up with karaoke 24/7. Oh, that's just too much for people to bear. Half an hour of that, people shouting, singing out of tune. Oh, it's just crazy stuff. But anyway, the point is, you make your hell realm. They're custom designed, what you think you deserve. And you stay there for however long you think you need to pay off your karmic debts. No one sends you there. You volunteer to go. It's called guilt. And the nice thing is that you don't need to go there. For goodness sake, let it go. Forgive yourself. But can people do that? Crazy, you try and you counsel people, they've done something wrong, you made a mistake. Now what about all the wonderful things? I'm a terrible person, I'm hopeless. They lose all their self-esteem, they feel guilty, they seek for punishment. Ask any psychologist. You have a relationship, you kill it because you don't think you deserve to be happy. Always punishing yourself. And you can understand why people at the end of their life send themselves to hell for that. The doors of hell are always open. You can walk out any time you like. It's only your guilt and your feeling you need to be punished for something you did. That is the problem. And that's why here we say, but let it go, compassion, forgive. No punishment in Buddhism, so let it go. And then you don't need to go to hell anymore. And the dog cow ascetic, I just made a mistake, stupid thing to do. I'm sorry, let it go, and they never need to get a hell rebirth. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I'm in the market for replacement sandals. Your thoughts, please. My current issues, toe chafing, unreliable alignment, mild trench foot, regards something, P. Birkenstock. No, so you want new sandals. Instead of getting new sandals, how about getting new feet? And to get new feet, so you don't have toe chafing, unreliable alignment, or mild trench foot, wear socks. Put some ointment on. So instead of trying to change your sandals, try to change your feet. It's one of Ajahn Chah's stories. He said once, there was a man walking in the forest, and he saw a well, or a hole in the ground. And at the bottom of the hole in the ground, there's this big pile of gold coins in a bag. And so he leant down to try and reach it, but he couldn't quite reach it. He stretched and stretched, but couldn't get to the gold coin, so he went away. He met another man, he said, it's just really awful. Even though I've got long arms, there's a big pile of gold in that hole there, but the hole is too deep. And the man said, you're so stupid. That man got a stick and hooked the bag up. The problem was that the hole wasn't too deep. The problem was your arm was too short. So I'm going to lengthen my arm with a stick and then I can hook it up. So often problems in the world just come from wrong perspective. It's not that your shoes are not comfortable. It's your feet are not the right size. So don't complain. Okay. This is, had you made love to your girlfriend and not just had sex. Your thoughts may be a little different, but then making love requires commitment, and that usually comes with marriage. Well, that must have come from a born-again Buddhist. I did love my girlfriend, and we were committed. We were together about 6 months. But it was a beautiful experience. So it wasn't the fact there was no commitment there. It wasn't just for pleasure that you had sex in those days. It was really beautiful. But the jhanas were even more beautiful. Or the deep meditations were even more beautiful. So it's not because there was no commitment there. Anyway, what is the difference between just being involved with your girlfriend and being committed with marriage? How many people are married are really committed? Or they just, when it gets tough, they just go and get divorced. Or as we say here in Australia, we don't have divorce in Buddhism in Australia. We call it recycling, not divorce. You get recycled, not divorced. But anyway, the difference between involvement and commitment, I say this at most weddings I do, the difference between involvement and commitment is the difference between bacon and eggs. Do you understand? Bacon and eggs. In bacon and eggs, the chicken is involved, but the pig is committed. The pig is his whole life. Anyway, Dhruvachan, can I dedicate merit to myself and all beings without, say, to my father, my mother, my sister, my brother, my husband, etc.? What's the best way to repay our parents? The best way to repay your parents is to actually to do something which they would be proud of. That's the way I remember. I was not English, not born as a Buddhist, but I always think of my parents. The best way I can pay back what they gave to me is to be a good son that they would be proud of. Work really hard as a Buddhist monk, as a teacher, to help and serve as much as I can. And that's the way I pay off my debts to my parents and my teacher as well. That's why I dedicate merits to them, by being a good person. Dear Ajahn, what is anatta sanya? That is perceiving things through the idea there's no self. So you're meditating. It's not me meditating. It's just a meditation happening, the cause and effect process. It's not, I'm only a visitor to my meditation. I'm not an owner. All those sorts of things are the perception of non-self. So it's wonderful that when you're meditating here, when you are getting nowhere, it's not you getting nowhere, it's just cause and effect, it's not your fault. Don't get proud when it works and think, ah, I'm a great meditator now. Take the I out of all this meditation, and the meditation gets so easy, so peaceful, so happy. As I said, the path is, but the traveller, the I, is not seen. The more you vanish, the easier meditation becomes. When a person attains nirvana, the person will vanish. Could he, she reappear again in this world or any other realm if he or she wants to? There's no wanting. They can't control the wants. The one is just part of the illusion of a self. That all disappears. You're just part of nature. When a person gets enlightened after their death, they just vanish. Gone. It's not in their power because the will is not theirs. Aha! Another one for Bianca. Does Bianca have psychic powers? How does she do all the things that she does? P.S. Thank you, Bianca. About a dozen exclamation marks. Well, Bianca, your powers? You say you haven't got them? See, people with psychic powers would say that. They haven't got them. So that proves she is. You know that Life of Brian? You know, are you the Messiah? Are you the Messiah? In the Life of Brian, Monty Python movie. And he says, I'm not the Messiah. And someone says, it says in the text that he will deny he's the Messiah. He must be the Messiah. Whatever way, if they believe you've got these things, you can't prove otherwise. I am a young monastic. Who's this one? I am still seeking kindness, care and appreciation from others. And this has given me a lot of suffering. People help to understand why these things come up and how to successfully overcome them. Whenever you seek something, you'll only find suffering. If you stop seeking, kindness is there. Care and appreciation from others. Human beings are just usually so kind and caring. But if you try and make it happen, you just spoil it. So even in this retreat here, the people in your cottage, you are kind and caring to one another. You're trying to do your best. Sometimes you fail. But, you know, underneath all that, you are kind and caring, and you do appreciate from others. So sometimes you can actually show that just by a little smile. You know, if somebody is sick, giving them a cup of tea or something, or whatever they like, find out what they like. You find that somebody, and this happens very often, find that you'd be sitting next to somebody at breakfast time, they always like some, say, toast with some jam on it, and it's the last of the jam. You go and make them a piece of toast with their favourite jam and you give it to them. It gives you so much happiness. For example, I'm going to embarrass you now, Venerable Chaka. When the Thai people came yesterday, and I was out there doing the interviews, and they realised, they knew I was going over to Bodhinyana Monastery for lunch, so they had a little bag of chips, you know, French fries, and they put it in a bag and they gave it to me when I was the last interview. And I smelled, what did they put in there? And it was some chips, hot chips. And so, you know, I ate some myself and gave some to another couple of other monks. It was only just a small little packet. And I realized Venerable Chaga, he's from Liverpool, he loves his chips too. He was up in the room over there, so I made a beeline for the room, knocked on the door, disturbed his meditation. They had some chips. And the smile on his face was so huge that that was the best moment of the day for me. And when you care and kind to other people, it's so much better than eating them yourself. And I like chips. But giving them to somebody else, so much fun and happiness. And that is how you create a community. That is how you have a wonderful time here. Look after one another. Whatever food it is, you're sitting next to each other, you know what they like. And put it on their plate for them. Something, a banana. You know they always like a banana. You take one and just put it on their plate. This is for you. It's much better than eating it yourself. And that's actually how you see kindness, care, and appreciation from others, by giving it to others. If a nimitta is a mental representation of a sensory perception, shouldn't its type quality be drawn from the sense of the meditation object? For example, light nimittas being more productive of kasina practice, whereas breath meditation involves tactile nimittas of bliss? No. The nimitta, these are just how a person perceives the sixth sense, the jitta, the mind. It's just, every nimitta is exactly the same, you see exactly the same thing, but you interpret it in different ways. And because human beings are mostly visual, yeah, people say they're very feely-feely, but most of your brain is taken up with visual objects, more than anything else. I'm not a neuroscientist, but I'm sure that most neuroscientists would say that most of the brain, the biggest proportion, is taken up with dealing with processing visual imagery. Because that's our major sense. You go to the airport, you present your passport, and they don't ask you to speak. Yeah, they sometimes do your fingerprints in some countries, but mostly they look at your photo. The visual, that is how you recognize one another, by visual. Dogs are mostly smell. So they know who you are by your smell, but we know who we are, not by the sound of our voice, but by the sight. We are so, our five senses, the dominant one is seeing, which means that that is why, that when the five senses vanish, we interpret this mind through our dominant sense, which is sight. It appears as an image. It's not an image. It's like a light, but it's not a light. That's actually how we experience it. This is the way perception works. The closest object in our experience so far to this thing called the mind, and that closest object is nearly always a light. So that's why nimittas traditionally and all the time appear as lights. Nothing to do with kasina practices, nothing to do with the breath, it's just the way we interpret things. Do we need to keep on bringing kindness, peace into our meditation, or only the beginning of a meditation that takes off by itself? If ever you get stuck in the meditation, nothing is really happening, kindness is a wonderful thing to bring up. I often do that. sometimes I'm meditating and I think, hang on, something is missing. And I always try kindness first of all, just a little bit of kindness, and meditation just takes off. Just like, you know, making a curry, making a soup, you know, you're making the soup and you taste it, that needs a bit of kindness. So you put a bit of kindness in, taste it, oh yeah, that's nice. That's like meditation, just a little bit of seasoning with kindness. So you can do it any time, all times. Is it bad karma if you leave your very good husband to be ordained? He would be devastated. I would create immense suffering for him and perhaps guilt for myself. Please advise. It is. A lot of times, if you talk to your husband, if he's a very good husband, he will understand that, you know, that, you know, that it's really wonderful to see you as an ordained person. There are many wives and many husbands, many engineers, accountants, bus drivers in this world, but there's very few, especially bhikkhunis. So we need more. And whatever job you have, whether it's in IT or in nursing, it's a very, very uncertain times in the economy. Many people are being sort of, you know, losing their jobs, being made redundant. But if you really want job security, monks never get the sack. Nuns. You have absolute job security for the rest of your life. The pay's not much good, but job satisfaction, you can't beat being a monk and nun for job satisfaction. And the retirement benefits are out of this world. So, yeah, so, you know, if that's the case, you talk with your partner. And a lot of time, if you came up to me and said, my partner really doesn't want me to be ordained, then I probably would not ordain you. Say, no, just talk it over. Get the okay from them, first of all. And after a while, they probably will give you the okay. And then bring them along to the ordination. And then it's a beautiful thing to see, you know, your partner offer your robes to you. This happens. And they just cry with joy. It's inspirational. Here you've been together, husband and wife, partners for a while. But now, sort of different stages of our life, now's the time to ordain and do something good for the world. So it's a wonderful thing. So talk with the husband. So it's not really bad karma, because your intentions aren't bad. If you ordain to spite him, I'm going to show you, I'm going to ordain, meh, then that's bad karma. But if your intentions are pure, it's always good karma. But I would ask you to, you know, have a chat and just, after a while, when you say you want to ordain, first of all they say no, but after a while they come around. Dear Venerable Sir, could the aircon please be switched on in the meditation hall in the morning as well? I find it too hot to meditate in the morning. First, well, take off your jacket, take off the robe. I better not go any further than that, otherwise it'll be getting a bit rough. Some people like it cold, some people like it hot. And you can never please everybody. That's why you have your own room sometimes. So you can make your own room as cool or as warm as you want, hopefully. And if it's too hot in your room, then just go into the toilet and just put a wet towel over you. But it's not that bad weather at the moment. Yeah, too hot to meditate in the morning. It's sometimes people find it too cold. It's really up to you guys. So for me, just hot, cold, I just go with whatever you want. So let's have a quick show of hands. Who thinks we should put the aircon on in the morning? Put your hand up. Who thinks we shouldn't? Okay, sorry guys, the shouldn'ts win. Actually, the apathy won, most of all. Most people don't care. Okay, your emptiness. Long ago you have mentioned that after deep meditation you were able to go back to the very early days of this life. Could you kindly share with us how you perceive the world as a 1 or 2 month old baby? I'm curious to understand the development of perceptions at early day of one's life prior to getting bombarded with knowledge and education that comes externally. Oh, thanks. Yeah, I've got to be careful sometimes because there are rules which I have to keep. And they're very good rules. And one is not actually to tell you too much about, you know, experiences or psychic stuff or enlightenment and stuff like that. So it's very... it's very sort of frustrating sometimes, but there is, because I know these rules really well, and it's like this is a loophole. you're not supposed to say about your previous lives. Let's just say previous lives. So I can go back to my early life experience. Because it's a bit sort of on the edge here because it is special experience. But I do this because I can and get away from breaking a rule. But it's also inspiring. Because after a good meditation, I won't say how much good meditation, but after a really powerful meditation, you come out afterwards, you know your mind is really easy to work with. It's got power. You feel that. And so one day I decided, coming out of a nice meditation, to ask the question, what is my earliest memory? As a way to sort of see if you can remember past lives. But instead of remembering a past life at this juncture, I got this memory of an early life, of an early part of this life, being a baby in the pram, this little walker which your mother would push you around in. And I don't know exactly how old I was, but it would only be like a couple of months. And it wasn't like a memory like, what did you eat this morning for lunch? This was actually being right back there in the table in front of your plate, putting the food in your mouth. It's like a re-experiencing. Which was really weird, because it's not the same as the other memories. This is, you're back there again. And the first thing which I noticed, which was really weird, was that I recognized most things by their smell. My dominant sense was smelling. Yeah, you could see, but that was not how I recognized everything. It was the smell of, you know, the blanket, the smell of the toys, the smell of my mum. It was her odor. Which was a dominant part of my consciousness. And there's also, you had the ability, you could actually explore. So I was exploring, you know, sitting in, it was actually in the Hall of Bodhinyana, I think, sitting in there and just exploring the pram in which I spent so many hours of my early life, exploring it, seeing it. And the thing which I came across was the little toy. This plastic, no, it wasn't plastic, where's I think it was ceramic, a little light blue pig called Porky. Okay, not much doubt there, but my mother, it had like these, must be beads inside, and she would walk it and shake it and make a sound. And I loved that little toy as a two-month-old kid. So you could explore and feel and especially smell. And so when I came out, I thought, wow, this is amazing, just you're back there. And one of the interesting things was, when I tell that story, there's many people in the audience, and there's one person who knew enough about, what is it, when babies, looking after babies, gynecology or whatever, and said, exactly, that's amazing, because according to anatomy, the first part of your senses, which grows as a baby, is your sense of smell. You do actually recognize things through smell, much more than through sight. I said, that's well known in baby science. He said, I know that's actually true because you can remember it. You remember what it's like. Smells are really important. And because I have a stupid sense of humor, I tell people, if you are a new mother, for goodness sake, do not change your perfume. Otherwise, the baby will not recognize who the hell you are. It's like, you know, changing your facial features. You don't recognize people. But the babies, the smell, that's how they remember you and recognize you. Smell their dad, smell their mum, smell their friends. So anyway, that's just an interesting part of that. This one over here, which I was just trying to unfold, this particular question, instead I'll just read it out, if I can get it open again. I tried folding this paper more, but it was hard. Thank you very much. From the sublime to ridiculous. I'll do a couple more, then we go to bed. What superfood or diet will help us get enlightened quicker? Okay, there must be a joke in here somewhere. Superfood or meditation will get you enlightened quicker. Okay. What's it? Ultralight milk get you enlightened? No. Kippers. I don't know about that. But anyway, no, it's the best food to get you enlightened is the Dhamma. That's the best superfood, the teachings. Dear Ajahn, the Gatikara Sutta is one of my favorites. Have you ever met any contemporary lay people who are anagamis? If so, could you elaborate on how they live life? If not, what is the closest analog and how do they live? I do know some people sort of here who, you know, have got the jhanas in these meditation retreats, and they live so simple lives. You know, no TV, and they don't go dressing up, and they just spend most of the time in simple little houses meditating. And they're not into money, and because they usually give up their job and get a small pension, you don't need much to live in this world if you don't sort of have to eat fancy food, wear fancy clothes, go on holiday. Who wants to go on holidays? Stay where you are. And that is such a simple life. Those are the sorts of people who an anagami would be like. Or you can come and join a monastery. But interesting seeing lay people do that. No sex anymore with their partners, and sometimes leave their partners just live quietly by themselves. No, not doing very much. Just like Gatikara. So I've seen a few people like that. You know, they meditate a lot, they get the jhanas, and the whole lifestyle style changes. They're not interested in, like, movies and TV and stuff like that. They're just so into the Dhamma and live such a simple life. And you don't know who they are because they don't go telling everybody, I'm an anagami. They don't wear an anagami suit or a badge which says, I am an anagami. You don't know who they are. They just disappear, basically. Oh, I just said that was the last question, but... Oh, almost 9:30. One more question, quick. Dear Ajahn, please can you explain the thinking behind having chocolate, cheese and gummies at tea time? Thanks. No, I can't explain that thinking. That you draw a line somewhere and sometimes the line falls on... So there's things which you like, and you think, wow, wonderful. Sometimes it falls on the other line, you can't have this. And I spent so much of my life as a monk answering questions on what can go into your mouth and what can't go into your mouth, and what time it can go in and what time it can't go in. At this age of my life, I'm fed up with that. It's more important what comes out of your mouth than what goes into it. So, yeah, there is a reason for that. And sometimes, yeah, this way, that way, it's not really important. So, yeah, you've got cheese, you don't have to eat it. It's optional. You have chocolate, you don't have to eat it. I shouldn't say this, but I know some people, they bring noodles and all sorts of other stuff in there, and they eat it in the choir. But I know what you get up to, and you've got my permission to do that. So, as long as you don't let people know. I remember when I was at college, you know, in university, it was an all-male college, but it was in the 60s, 70s. Everybody knew you had the girlfriends in there overnight. But the porters told us, you know, they're supposed to be the gatekeepers. Look, guys, don't do things stupid. We know what goes on, but as long as we don't see it, there's no problem. If we see it, then we have to report it. So, you know, that was a wonderful thing. Be smart about it. Just, and if you're smart about it, there's no problem. But some people are just so stupid, and they're just so blatant, and that they get caught, and they spoil it for everybody. It got so much that the group of students in our students' union in our college, Emmanuel College, we made a submission to the governing body of the professors and dons. And they said, can we please allow women to come into breakfast, you know, for the morning breakfast? Because an all-male college. And, you know, first of all, you know, why would women need to come in for breakfast? It's because they were breaking the rules and staying overnight. But, you know, it was a bit of a cheeky request from the dons in Cambridge. But the dons rose to the occasion, and they responded to our formal request from the students. Said, your request to have women come in to breakfast in the morning has been declined on the grounds that gentlemen do not appear their best at that time of the morning. That was just so English. It's true, you don't appear your best in the morning, but neither does your girlfriend, so it doesn't really matter so much. But anyway, that was all these things, what you can do, what you can't do, just, it's there, so just don't think about it. Okay, so there's a few questions left, but I think I've made progress. There's less questions left than there were last night, so we're getting there. Sadhu. 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 Very good. Okay, so have a wonderful night tonight and see you in the morning. If you want some cheese, you can have some cheese or some chocolate. Well, what they did in England, they found out all these amazing ways of putting cheese and chocolate and everything else which is allowable together. And they made these incredible concoctions of what was allowable. They even used, in Thailand, they managed to make ice cream out of Coffee Mate. And that could kill you. It's probably really unhealthy for you, but you know, where there's a desire, there's a way. It's so crazy. Anyway, just have a nice evening.